Welcome, listeners, to a brand new bonus episode of the Oh My Word podcast. And today, we have a really special guest with us, an author and also a college teacher mentor, but we'll hear more about that soon, Lisa Grove Frostino. Lisa, welcome. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So starting from the beginning, how did you get into writing? Is it something you fell into? Is it something that you always wanted to do?
I would say always is the right answer, because I wrote my first story on a toilet seat when I was about 3 or 4 years old. I scribbled it in crayon on the top of the toilet seat. And I asked my mother to read it to me. And she said, that doesn't say anything. Clean that up. It's because I had not yet cracked the secret code of the alphabet and how the letters combined to create words that people that knew how to read could read back to you.
Right.
So I could not wait to go to school and learn to write. And I was an avid reader throughout my childhood. I was one of those kids that always had books, libraries, yay, libraries. Yeah, I grew up in rural Maine in a family that didn't have much money, so we didn't have a lot of books in our house. We did have a few. My great-grandmother, who had been a school teacher when she was young, read to us from the Grimm's fairy tales. She was in her 90s, I believe.
Wow.
And we would gather around her, because she was disabled at that point, and we would gather around her in her room, and she would read to us in this very thick Maine accent. And she would also read from Pippi Longstocking. That's how she pronounced it. So Pippi Longstocking became my hero at a very early age. That grandmother helped me learn to write the alphabet on a little chalkboard, a little black chalkboard that you could, you know, erase. So I could sit with her next to her on her bed, and she could show me the letters, and I could copy them. And so I wanted to write from the time I was little. I just didn't know at that point all the ins and outs of it, right? And when I got to college, I didn't really believe that I would have anything to say that anybody else would want to read, because I wasn't very old. I didn't have a lot of experiences in life. So I thought at first that I would become a teacher, since I loved reading and writing so much. And my greatest fantasy when I was about, I would say, 12 years old was to get spelling tests. So,
oh my goodness. Wow.
But eventually I figured out that I wanted to write for children, because I had loved children's books so much when I was a kid myself.
Right.
And because I decided I wanted to write at such an early age, I felt like that was an experience I could draw from and write something that the audience would maybe be interested in reading. And so I started, even when I was still in college, studying up and learning how to write for children. At that time, they didn't have the children's literature classes that are out there now, or even the graduate program that I direct now, and I'm sure we'll get back to that in a bit.
Yeah.
But I read a lot on my own. I wrote a lot. I took every creative writing class that I could. They weren't focused on children's writing, but, you know, writing is writing at some level. You learn to develop characters, you learn to spin your narration and control it, you learn to use dialogue and create a certain place with your setting and all those things. And that applies as well to children's books as it does to adult books. So, yeah, that's how I got into writing. And then it was in the, when I was a young mother myself, that I really became serious about trying to get my work published. I had been on and off about it. I think early on I was quite sensitive to rejection. I didn't understand how the publishing world really, really worked at that point.
Right.
When I was young, I thought at that point that if it was good enough, then of course any editor would take it. You know, anyone
right.
would see that it was good.
Right.
And anyone would publish it. And so if I got one rejection, in abject despair that I was never going to be good enough.
Wow.
But as I got a little older and more mature, I researched the publishing business as well, and knew that the taste comes into it, that marketing comes into it,
right.
that timing comes into it.
Yep.
There's so much that comes into it. And if you have the passion to do it and the aptitude to do it, you just really need to develop the stick to it the best and the thicker skin to handle rejection and also do the work to figure out where the best place would be for your submission. So one year I decided, okay, this is the year I'm going to write, and I'm going to keep my work all circulated out there. And if I don't sell anything in this year, then that will be my message that I'm not cut up to be a writer. And I did. I sold, I think, at least three magazine stories during that year.
Wow.
And that, so I had my message from the universe that I could continue.
Did you ever return to any of the stories that were rejected earlier to try to either recirculate them or like fix them up and resend them out, or once something was rejected, to like put it aside, move on to something new?
You know, I have not looked at those in a long time. That was the 80s, the late 80s, I believe, the mid to late 80s.
Right.
And there were times back in the early days when just to reinforce my sense of confidence that I would look at them.
Right.
Yes, I am a published author and see my name in the magazine.
Yeah.
But after some time, they're just something that's in my past. Maybe someday I'll pull them out and look at them. But I haven't in a long time.
I have to ask, first of all, I'm so impressed with your great-grandmother. That it's just so amazing. But she would read you the Grimm fairy tales, like the original Grimm fairy tales as kids, without like softening any of those tales. As kids, she was just reading about like people eating each other or dancing their feet off in like iron boots. That was like, she read those?
I don't actually remember feeling horrified or shocked or upset by any of the Grimm's tales when my great-grandmother read them. I think maybe, I really don't have a strong recollection of how she situated them.
Right, okay.
Because I was so young at that time.
Right.
But I imagine there were probably conversations. And there was a group of children of extended family there. Some of them were older than me. I was the oldest one in my direct family. There were, my father had cousins who were a lot younger than he was, but older than I was. And they were there at that time. And I think it might have been closer to how the folk actually have told those tales back in the day. They were kind of floating in the air in a mixed group of people, young and old. And so the reactions would have been tempered, I think, by that. And in a safe environment with your loved ones sharing these stories. I think that sometimes those darker stories have a sort of humor to them, a black humor to them that were intended to be mocking. So for example, when in the Grimm's version, when Cinderella's stepsisters cut off their feet to fit into the glass slipper, it's actually kind of funny because that's kind of a dumb thing to do. I think at age 4, I knew that was a stupid thing to do.
Yeah, okay.
Right? And so it was making fun of these people that would do something so stupid to be married to a prince. And also a remark on the aristocracy, sort of making fun of the aristocracy who make themselves useless.
Right.
They don't need their feet.
Right.
I'm like, we working class folks who need our feet to go out and do our work and get around.
Right.
If you're in the nobility, you can just sit around and have people wait on you. So I think that perhaps the circumstances of how I heard the stories led me to not feel them as scary.
Right.
But I do see why some people feel that way about them. And you just, when I work with the tales with my students, and we had this discussion about are they age appropriate, the answer is, well, maybe or maybe not. It depends on the child, depends on your relationship with the child, depends on other things that your child is reading and whether they are ready.
Well, actually, the way you just described it, that as a child, that's a silly thing to do because people need their feet. Kids get that. You don't have to explain to them about why we need feet or whatever. They all get you need your feet. So to move around, you shouldn't do something silly to them kind of thing. Or See, I never thought about it like that. So this is also, that you started writing for kids kind of in the 80s and to now where we are now. Have you seen, aside from the fact that now they'll actually have classes, for children's literature much more, have you seen massive changes in children's literature? Because growing up, I didn't see a lot of young adult on the shelves. And now young adult, the industry has become really massive and you could get sort of that. So have you seen major changes in the industry since you did start writing or from growing up?
Oh, absolutely huge changes. Absolutely huge changes and wonderful changes over the last 30 years since I've been in this business and teaching in this business. Right now, the biggest, most wonderful change is the recognition of the need for diverse books and own voices books. The lanes are opening up for these people to tell stories and these characters to come alive on the pages for all children to see. I think that's amazingly wonderful. And then previous to that, the opening up of graphic novels and comic book stories.
Right.
And when I was a child, my I had a grandmother who loved comic books. Well, she was this awesome grandmother who loved the National Star and those, what was the name of those other, like, those kinds of newspapers and magazines where the aliens are on the cover and speculative kinds of stories. But she loved those, and she loved comic books. And so when I would visit her, I would read all of her comic books. She had the Archie comics. She had all the Superman, Wonder Woman. I love Wonder Woman. She had the Richie Rich and the Donald Ducks. Just all those popular things from back in the 60s, 70s. So I always felt, as somebody who was an avid reader, you know, I was reading Wuthering Heights when I was 10 or 12, but I also was reading comic books.
Right.
And I loved them both. And I was reading toothpaste, you know, containers.
Right, right.
Anything that had words on it, basically, I was reading. Anyway, now I think the role of visual literacy and visual storytelling has been recognized at a higher level. And so since we've started to recognize books like American Boy Chinese, which is the first graphic novel to get the Prince Award, or Persepolis, just so many wonderful graphic novels now. El Defo is a more recent one that has gotten the Newbery Honor, I believe. So there's a recognition that children enjoy pictures. Alice in Wonderland said famously, "What good is a book without pictures?"
Yeah.
So now we have given literary recognition to books that have pictures. And so I think that's another big one. I think another big one that has happened is a lot of loosening up of taboos. When I started writing, you would not be able to get away with a book about everyone pooping.
Right. Okay, you know? Right.
And now poop is everywhere.
Right. I don't know if that's a good thing.
No, I think it is a good thing to be to pull away taboos that were based on things that are not of our time.
Right, right, right. I once spoke to an author that she said, I think she had some young adult fiction out and she had some adult fiction out. She had two different agents for it. And she said that she sometimes feels like there's sort of this stigma that unless you write for adults, then like you're not like a real writer. Like, oh, you're like a children's writer or something else. Have you seen that at all? Or do you think that's or not necessarily?
Oh, I've totally seen that in my career. I don't know if it's as prevalent today as it once was, because I think a lot of people today are reading YA.
Right.
A lot of adults are reading YA. I think Harry Potter did a lot for that. I think The Hunger Games did a lot for that.
Yeah.
There are several series, especially the dystopian ones, that have reached a wide audience of all ages, and I think that helps a bit. Also, the rise of the literary awards for young adult work has helped. But I think there are still a lot of people with elitist attitudes thinking that writing for children can't be all that serious or deep. Children can understand it if it's for children, if that's the audience, and that YA isn't as good as adult because it's narrowed in on the concerns and the worldviews and the needs of adolescent characters. I totally disagree with them, but I have actually, been on the receiving end of those kinds of conversations. I think my favorite story to tell about this is a colleague of mine back when I was professor at Eastern Connecticut State University. I'm the author of a book called The Hickory Chair. It's a picture book illustrated by Benny Andrews and published by Arthur Levine Scholastic. It came out in 2001, so it's kind of an old book now, but it did get a lot of attention when it came out. And when I came up for full professor, I think it was, one of my colleagues was reading all of my work. It was in my tenure dossier, in my promotion dossier. And that was one of the works that was in there. And she wrote me a note telling me how surprised she was how good it was.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
She didn't realize that children's literature could be so good. Yeah. So even at that level, someone, your colleague who you know, you've been in department meetings with and they see that you're fairly intelligent, they've seen your scholarly work too, and they know that you have a couple of marbles to scratch together. To be surprised that a children's book could be a caliber that they would respect. That's one of my favorite stories.
Yeah, it's great. It's so great. Well, it's funny because anybody who's in the children's book world can probably name off the top of their head, you know, 15 to 20 books that they think are the most brilliant book ever. And some of those are going to be picture books. But I guess for people who don't see it as that, they're like, how could a picture book be so brilliant? It's like, have you tried it?
Yeah. Honestly, I mean, I've published everything from poetry to picture books, middle grade, young adult. My first published novel was a middle grade. My PhD dissertation was a young adult novel. I've edited collections of short stories for young adults. I've done all of it, really.
Right.
And I think the hardest is picture books. And I think they've even gotten harder because another trend that I see that's different over the course of my career has been the evolution away from picture storybooks toward purely picture books. I think we still do occasionally get a picture storybook, and by that I mean a story that you could read without the pictures and you don't really lose the narrative. And I would say my book, The Hickory Chair, would be a picture storybook. I love the illustrations by Benny Andrews. I think they add to the story, but it is also the kind of story that you might see in a reader for third grade with no illustrations and using it as a story, right? And there used to be a lot more of those kinds of picture books. Now, writing a picture book requires an author to truly be able to think like an illustrator and leave enough room in the writing for the illustrator to add visual narrative. That's something, I mean, actually, I think it's improving a lot of books. It's making picture books stronger as a hybrid kind of form with counterpoint between the words and pictures. I like to point to Matt DiLapina's Last Stop on Market Street as a great example of good picture book writing, and it did deserve to get the Newbery Award because of this, because if you really do a close analysis of that book, you can see where the descriptions that he uses are of other senses besides visual very often. And so it leaves Christian Robinson, leaves him more room to show the action through the art. And the action that DiLapina does use consists of either very strong action verbs that show movement or beautiful kind of lyrical language that the story would lose something if it weren't there. So I think that this drive to have these shorter stories that give the artist more room for narrative, you know, it's good. It can be a very good thing. It is frustrating for those of us who like to write stories that are illustrated, but you know, I feel like something is a bit missing there, and maybe it'll swing back because that's what publishing does, swings back and forth over time. But that doesn't mean that these strong picture books, true picture books with the text and the art both contributing to the narrative, those are always going to be here now, I think, because they're just so good.
Yeah, yes, they are. Just to shift a little bit, I really want to talk about this because I'm so excited with this book. How did you get, are you invited to write as part of a series, the Dear America series, which takes different parts of American history, so that's all standalone books, even though it's part of the wider series. So how do you get invited to something like that? Or do you have to check out other books in the series to know how you're supposed to write or what kind of guidelines you get? How does something like that come about?
Well, for me, that was partly a personal journey I was on because I had friends who were writing for the Dear America series, for one thing. So I was very familiar with it. Like one of my friends, Kate, brought her drafts to writers group too. Critique. So,
right.
I was that close to that. But also, I was publishing with Scholastic at that time, and I had a good friend who was an editor at Scholastic, not of the Dear America series, but of other works. And when I used to get together with her, you know, she'd say, oh, you could get in on the Dear America. You'd be so good at it, and you'd contribute something good to the series. It'd be really good for you because the money was good at that time. So I got in touch with the series editor and asked if they'd be interested in a proposal for me, and they were. And I submitted several different proposals. And each time I submitted a proposal, they said, oh, that's a great idea. We already have that one under contract with so-and-so, and this one's under contract with another one. Right. So finally, I submitted one that they loved the idea of. And so they asked me to do a more thorough proposal with a sample chapter outline and all that. And I did it, and they liked it, but they turned it down because of the politics of the moment. I won't go into the details about it, but they just didn't deem it to be wise to publish it at that time.
Uh-huh.
So then I was very frustrated because they had invited the proposal.
Right.
So I said to them, well, if you're interested in my work, can you tell me some things that you'd like to see developed? And if there's anything there that appeals to me, then, you know, I would love to work up a proposal then.
Right.
So they did. They gave me a list. They gave me a list of, I think, maybe three topics that they were interested in that they didn't have anything under contract for yet. And on that list was the Salem Witch Trials, and it jumped right out at me because I had done my senior project in high school on the Salem Witch Trials. I still had the paper. I dug it out, looked at it. I grew up in the state of Maine, which used to be part of Massachusetts back at that time. So I had a kind of historical interest in it that went all the way back to high school. I felt like that was safe then, that I was going to do the Salem Witch Trials.
So even the previous ones that you'd written either the sample for or the proposals for, you didn't have to do a bunch of research before you wrote that? You figured I'll do the sample first and then I'll go do the research?
I did a lot of research, but it was a topic that I already knew a lot about.
Oh, okay.
Because it was a topic that I was involved in teaching. At that time in my life, I was teaching fifth grade at an independent school. I was teaching the English classes. It was a model of a middle school model, a team model, where we had a reading teacher. I was an English teacher. We had a social studies teacher, science teacher, math teacher, et cetera. So the students had different teachers for each subject. And we worked together as a team, and we did a local history unit. So the topic that I had proposed was very closely related to the local history, something that happened in that town. And so I already had done a lot of research on it for the teaching unit. And so to work up a proposal, I just had to do some additional research to find the storyline that would be appropriate for a child audience. So it didn't create me as much extra work as it might look like, because it was a topic that was near and dear to me and that I knew something about.
When you did, you wrote this one, I Walk in Dread for the Salem Witch Trials. Like, if it's not if you're not writing a history book, so it doesn't require as many words or as much maybe depth into certain historical things, but if you have to write it correctly about what they're eating or what they're wearing, it still requires a lot of research. So, like, how do you go about approaching that and make sure that you don't, okay, I got my points, get out, before you just get sunk in the research of it?
Oh, well, for the Salem Witch Trials, that's a big one, because there are literally hundreds of years of history and
right.
and layers of myths surrounding it, a lot written about it. It took me a long time to dig down. So I did a ton on the Salem Witch Trials. Luckily, at the time that I was working on it, there were a couple of books that came out by scholars, historians, academics, who had been working on them for about 10 years at the time. And they were very, very thoroughly sourced, very carefully documented. So I had a trail that I could follow back and see where the myths had started and where they got picked up. And I was able, because of that, to work into my narrative multiple threads of possibility. I could trace back and see what all the theories had been over the centuries about why there was such mass hysteria in Salem and why people chose to do what they did and convict and hang these people they thought were witches. And so I was able to bring in all those different threads in the storyline as possibilities, but also the threads that historians now think were the more accurate ones. So
right.
I was lucky in that front. But that's how I have a PhD, so I'm a scholar as well as a creative writer, and I love research. I mean, I love it.
Yeah.
So I usually start with the academics. I try to find the most recent and respected academic books, and I look at their sources, and I kind of trace backwards doing historical research.
Right, because you have so little space to put so much in, or even like adding different details. So it's just Like, even, like, when there's a snowstorm, so the kid and his dad end up in their house, but it's two girls living alone, so it's not appropriate for them to be in the house together. That's something that you're not going to write out, you know. In those times, men and women are going to be in the house together if they were related to each other, but you still slide that in there. You have to know what you're talking about to be able to put that in there.
Yeah, and the other thing that helped with the details of that book is my own childhood growing up in Maine, because I was very intimately familiar with the kind of weather that they would have had with the snow. And also we had, my family had what we call camp up in Maine, which is like a cabin or cottage on a lake, but no electricity, no running water. And we would spend a lot of time in there. So I could imagine what it must have been like to live under those circumstances in ways that maybe a city dweller might not be able to now. It was a while ago that I wrote that book, right? Because it came out in 2004, and I think I was working on it around 2000. But I was writing, I was working on one of those winter scenes, and that day I was out for a walk, and I had to avoid mud because it was that time of year where you had both snow and mud, melting snow. And I realized, you know, when I was stepping over on a clod to avoid the mud, I'm going to have my character go home and do that.
Very good. When you write the epilogue for the book, do you just get to write whatever you want? Or is that kind of, if I had more space to write the story, this is what I would have written? Or you just make it up at that point? Or well, I guess you are making it up. It's fiction, but
I could write what I wanted, but there were length limitations on the story.
Right.
And also, I felt that at that point, because of the graphic nature of the Salem Witch Trials and what happened to characters, that I had provided enough of the feeling of the story to the reader where I didn't have to go further and into the darkness. I took the story arc to a place that felt like there was hope for my main character, and then I used the epilogue to skip the rest.
Right, right. That's the one thing, you know, with the Dear America series and things like that, is a lot of it is written at times that were hard for people, right? That's why they're notable. You're not going to write just a regular day on the farm. Something significant has to happen for it to that they put these stories around. So writing something like the Salem Witch Trials, which you kind of just mentioned this, that you're writing it for middle grade, they have to know that these things happen, but, right, how do you, because I remember when I was reading, I was like, I can't believe people did this to each other. Like, what is going on here? And then you realize that middle graders are reading it, but you have to know what people did. You have to realize history is a lesson. So how do you
It was the greatest challenge, really, of writing that book. It was the greatest challenge to figure out how to be honest about what happened without being terrifying or so dark that hope would be lost.
Right.
It was really atrocious what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to wrap your mind around what happened. But I did it through something that I think has happened throughout history. It always happens. There are always other perspectives on things than what the dominant story carries forward, right?
Right.
There have always been strong women who dared to speak up. There have always been people who have been silenced, and you don't know what they really would have said if they had not been silenced. And so part of it was trying in a believable way, that's very important. You have to believe that these characters would behave in this manner to get those voices out there. And I chose to do that through the character of Martha Corey, who was legendary of her time for running her mouth off. That's why she got accused of being a witch. And so I could take that historical figure and, based on what I could find in the historical accounts, imagine her as a friend of my main character. And through her, was able to bring a more reasonable, you know, logic-based and fairness-based, justice-based perspective on the trials as they were happening.
Even for your main character, that she's sort of skeptical of the whole thing to begin with, and then we see how she downright does not, she rejects it, but I don't know if that's the right word for it, but that's also kind of tricky to make sure that your character is going to make, I guess, the right decisions without seeming like they're too self-righteous, I guess, or too,
right.
I mean, you don't want to go to preachy because nobody wants that either, but I'm like, I don't know if that's an easier thing to write or a harder thing to write, or if you give them the right kind of mentors and they can say, oh, I see now how it could be like that. Because you have the people who did what they did that you want that to come across without being too scary, but then the people who are making the right choices without them being unrelatable because they're too perfect.
Right.
It seems that, like, historical fiction is not as big anymore, for younger audiences, or if it is, it's in very specific time periods. Would you say that that's kind of true, or just because publishing is kind of the pendulum that sometimes it goes, you know, more into fantasy or sci-fi or contemporary, and sometimes it will go back to historical fiction? Have you seen any change shift like that occur?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not positive because I haven't necessarily kept up with reading everything the way that I should, since I've been focusing on reading for my research mostly and teaching in the last few years. But it does seem to me, when I look at the books that get the most attention, that get awards or get shortlisted and that kind of thing, there isn't as much historical fiction as there used to be. But I do think also that librarians and scholars like historical fiction a lot, and they tend to overvalue it compared to other forms over time. You know, if you look at books that they love the most. And I understand that because I feel that way too. When I was a kid, I loved historical fiction as well. One of my favorite genres to read.
Yep.
I can imagine myself being in another place in time and what it might have been like then. So, yeah, I'm not sure it's being published as much now as it was, but again, I think it'll swing back. We've had the dystopian trend for a while. Before that was the paranormal trend. I think now, since we've been living in dystopia, we might be getting away from it.
Yeah.
We might be going to more how we cope with things and more imaginative, perhaps fantasy or maybe historical. I think this is a trend. If you look at children's literature over time, young adult literature, we tend to see during difficult historical periods examinations of other difficult historical periods. I mean, this isn't children's lit, but it's a common example that you could make about MASH. You know, it was very popular during the Vietnam era, but it was about Korea.
Right.
So we tend to, when struggling with current issues, it kind of can be hard to hit it on the nose and deal with it straight on at the moment, but you can deal with the themes that are related from other times. And so maybe we will be seeing more historical fiction coming out soon. We'll see.
I mean, I always hope so, because I do love historical fiction also, but I want all the books to be out. So, you know, that's not very helpful, but that's, you know, that's kind of how that is.
Yeah.
So what do you do now for Hollins? That you're running the master's program, some sort of master's program there?
Yeah. So Hollins University is located in Roanoke, Virginia, near the Blue Ridge Mountains. It's an absolutely beautiful campus and beautiful location. The undergraduate program is a women's-only university, and the graduate programs are co-ed. Our graduate programs are run in the summer for a six-week session from mid-June to the end of July. We started in 1992 with a master's degree, and it was the first of its kind in the U.S. because it combined both critical and creative coursework. The whole philosophy of this was, if you want to write, you should deeply study the work that you want to write, be a good close reader of the work you want to write, but also that scholars can benefit greatly from looking at how a work is constructed and thinking the way writers think. So we started in 1992, and at first, our master's students were probably more weighted toward the scholarly end of things, and a lot of our students who graduated during the early years of the program have since gone on to become PhD scholars who teach at universities, or librarians, or other academics, book reviewers, agents. I forget what year exactly it was, but somewhere in the tens, I think, or it might have been a little before that, we started an MFA in children's literature. So for creative writers to get a terminal degree in writing children's or young adult literature. And for that, they would take a couple of more creative writing courses, more intensive creative writing tutorials, and do a creative thesis. It's longer, more market-oriented than the thesis for the MA would have been. For instance, with the MA, somebody might have written a couple of short stories and an essay that goes with it. But for the MFA, they'd write the whole novel manuscript.
Oh, wow.
And then in about 5-7 years ago, maybe now, we added an MFA in writing and illustrating. And, oh, I left one out along the way. So before that MFA, we developed a certificate in illustration. So people who were artists and wanted to illustrate children's books would come get a certificate at Holland's. So then we combined the MFA and certificate ideas together to create the MFA in writing and illustrating. That's the degree that our student Rebecca Lowell got. You and I, before the interview, were talking a bit about Rebecca, who is a recent graduate of ours, who has a book coming out next year, her first book. So we have a pretty, I think, solid program now going for whatever you want to do with children's literature.
Wow.
We have students who are publishing books, students who are, not students, alumni, I should say, reviewing books, who work in libraries, who are teachers, who work in all different aspects, really, of children's literature.
Is the biggest thing with doing the either some sort of MFA program or something like that, not necessarily that you're going to become such a scholar, but that you have the guidance all the way through to complete what you're doing? Or is it kind of both that you're getting out of a program like this? Both, you know, the scholarly aspect of it and also the guidance as you're working on whatever your final project's going to be. Yeah.
Right. So all of our students in the master's or MFA tracks take a course that is a foundational course called the History and Criticism of Children's Literature.
Uh-huh.
So everybody learns about these, about where we've come from to for our field to evolve to where it is today, and various critical approaches scholars take and learn how to write critical papers. And this helps them actually as creative writers as well, if they're in the creative writing tracks, because they have a deeper understanding of what makes literature work over time. The students in all the tracks take a combination of critical and creative coursework, and it depends what they're going to end up doing for their thesis, what the balance of that will be. In that, if you wanted to get an MFA in writing children's literature or young adult literature at Holland's, you would take 4 critical literature classes and 4 creative writing classes, workshops, plus 2 advanced tutorials with a small group of students working on their thesis projects, and finally the thesis itself. By the time you're done with that, you have a pretty good knowledge of how children's literature works from the inside out.
Right. This is the summertime that this program runs.
Yes. Our program runs for 6 weeks. In that 6 weeks, it's very intensive.
Yeah.
These are full-length courses, like you would take if you went during the spring or the fall semester at a university. The professors are renowned scholars and creative writers and illustrators in their field, and they're there teaching a class. And the classes run, as you'd be familiar with, a standard college class with discussions and assignments that are turned in. It's different from the brief residency programs that many of us are familiar with in our field. They're both good, but it's a different model.
Right. By the way, I actually just thought of this right now, even though I'm going back a little bit to the Scholastic thing. When you pitched the book for the Dear America series, there was no agent involved with that? You just spoke directly to the editor that you had this relationship with?
Yes,
I did. Wow.
But that's because I had already been publishing with Scholastic.
Right.
And I got my first couple of contracts without an agent. So, well, it was more possible then than it is now.
Yeah, it's
the only thing that helped me with that is at that time in my life, I had founded the Eastern Pennsylvania chapter of the Society of Children's Book Writers before they added the illustrators. So I organized conferences and things. So at that point, I knew a lot of the editors in New York and other places. So that helped me. Nowadays, you know, I think it's really probably essential to have an agent. I think it's still possible to get in without one, but you know, even I'm showing my work to an agent now.
Yeah, it sounds like more of an exception that you were able to get in like that than...
It was quite common back then to not have an agent in children's publishing, but it's less common now. Some of the people that I know who started out without an agent back then still don't have one because they've worked with the same editors, but that's a pretty lucky situation.
Yes.
And nowadays, most people have experienced multiple editors and editors who've left or been downsized out of their positions and all of that. So it's more necessary to have help navigating and publishing now.
This is kind of an off-the-cuff question also. Do you think it makes a difference that there's more agents now to get you to editors? Do you think it's had any significant impact? Or just because if there's more writers, you have to have more gatekeepers almost? Or I don't know if you have any opinion on that.
Yeah, I think that probably has a lot to do with it because we have so many people wanting to write. A lot of people who are writing don't have a clear sense yet of how publishable their work is. And so if the people whose work isn't ready yet, they're sending it in. And it clogs up the works for everyone.
Yeah.
And so having agents be gatekeepers, I think, helps the publishing, helps the editors.
Even though it drives everybody else to anxiety, but yeah.
But, you know, I think that might have something to do with why graduate programs have risen up as being more popular, more and more popular, because
right.
By the time you get through Hollins or VCFA or Hamline or Spalding or any of the other ones, you do get a sense of where your work fits in, and your scores do help you decide on when the time is right. You get a better sense of how long it really takes to be a proficient writer and recognize where your work fits in with other people's work.
That's a good point. Because a lot of people, everyone writes to write a book, and a lot of people don't realize what has to go into writing the book, so... I mean, there's so much more to say about all this, but I think we're going to have to wrap up now. I always end with the fill in the blank question of, I love it when, you know, writers, agents, publishers, books, whatever you want to use there, do X, and I really don't like it when they do X. So how would you fill in the blank for both of those?
Okay. Well, I think that from the point of view of being an author and also sometimes an editor, the most important thing I want to see, and the flip coin of it is what I don't want to see.
Okay.
I want to see an editor or a critique group member or an agent or whoever is giving me feedback, someone who can kind of climb inside of what my vision for the work is and help me make it better. On the flip side of that, the thing I hate is when somebody takes a manuscript and tries to turn it into their own vision of it. They look at it and they say, oh, well, this could be so good if you did this and this and this and this. It is helpful if someone imagines what you can do with your manuscript once they understand what you want to do. But that's the first step, to be able to kind of climb inside the vision of the manuscript and then see where it is and isn't achieving that yet, and help with very useful ideas to let the author bring it along.
Amen. Well, that also shows you where, like, the really talented either critique partners or editors come in, is that they can help you with that instead of just trying to make it their own.
Yeah. And I think sometimes people don't even realize when they're doing it, when they're taking somebody else's project and pushing it where they would do it if it were their project. They think they're being helpful. But you know, it's always good to check in with an author and make sure you do understand what they're trying to do. We're asking questions instead of giving suggestions of what to do. It's one way to do it, you know. Just right. Try to pose everything that you are noticing as a question to the author. That one step in and of itself can make a big difference, I think. I found that as a writer, you know, being edited. Questions right. are always wonderful.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. All right. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for your time, and thanks so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate it. It was so great speaking with you.
Oh, it's great speaking with you.
This was a bonus episode featuring author Lisa Rowe Frostino. To find out more about Lisa and her work, check out the link in the episode notes. To find out more about Oh My Word Podcast, please follow us on Instagram or subscribe to Oh My Word Podcast at eltechnobs.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Catch you next time.